From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
As a person who gets overwhelmed every time I look at a pile, tell me and help me how to get through this. What do I do?
And I remember asking, you mean like pitch black, dark, can't see anything blind? And the ophthalmologist said, yes.
I really like never thought anything like this would happen, like to get to bring like Netflix and Bridgerton to Galway and bring Luke to Galway and show him round. And
coming up on this sunny Thursday edition of Playback Daily, let a Condo Marie consultant help you spark joy again. Being diagnosed with Stargardt disease and Bridgerton mania. Penelope and Colin spill the beans. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that had beans to spill once but couldn't find the tin opener. Let's begin the show today with Maura Doran sitting in for Oliver Callan, musing on, well, it's only Lady Gaga.
Now, I don't know if you have been following the story of Lady Gaga. She was at her sister's pre-wedding dinner the other day and she was wearing a little black dress. Now, a lovely little black dress, but whatever way the angle caught her, the camera angles caught her, she looked like she had a bit of a belly. Now, that can happen to all of us. I certainly wouldn't have got into that dress she was wearing. But anyway, it did look like she had a bit of a belly. But of course, the interweb went cracked saying Gaga is pregnant and all this kind of stuff. But of course she isn't. She had to come out and defend herself. And she said basically that first of all, I have to say that Taylor Swift has come out now to defend Gaga before all that. But Gaga basically said she was down bad. It was down bad, she said, and the gym. And that basically means down bad. I didn't know what it meant, but it means that you're kind of sad and you're feeling down. And it's actually a line from or a song in Taylor Swift's new album called Down Bad. That is the song. So Taylor came out and she said it's invasive and irresponsible to comment on a woman's body. And Lady Gaga doesn't owe anyone an explanation and neither does any woman. Now, to be honest, I really feel that it's women that get this grief. If it was a guy with a bit of a belly, we would never even comment. And Lady Gaga has a lot more to do in the world than coming out, giving out about people saying this about her. But Taylor Swift is right. She is right. I mean, the grief that women, especially stars, get, people that are caught on camera the whole time with a bad angle, it can happen to anyone. I mean, maybe Gaga wasn't in the mood to do 800 sit-ups in the gym. Maybe she was feeling down bad for a while. Who knows what's going on in their lives? And I see across the water in the UK, Carrie Mulligan and Keira Knightley, they're among 25 signatories asking for funding to set up a new authority where actors and creative can go and get help for harassment and bullying. And I think before the whole Me Too movement, we looked on at these stars' amazing lives and thought everything was rosy and everything was perfect and they had such great lives. But behind it all, there is always a darkness in everyone's lives. And, you know, nothing is ever positive. There's always kind of negative sides to whatever job you have. But fair play to Taylor Swift for coming out and backing Gaga. And I hope that authority gets set up in the UK.
Hear, hear. And let's have one for Ireland as well. From Gaga to Corey. That's a soap, I think.
Gail Platt in Coronation Street, aka Helen Wirth. She is quitting the cobbles after 50 years. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I grew up with Coronation Street and I know things have changed in television land and watching the soaps. It's not the religion that it was. I mean, we sat down, was it twice a week? Or I can't remember even as kids watching Corrie with the parents. We weren't supposed to be watching it sometimes. But it was really, it always echoed real life. And all of the soap storylines, they really do kind of echo real life, whatever they're going through, the trauma or whatever is kind of in the news and the media. They're very smartly get them into the storylines of the shows. Coronation Street was always like that. I know EastEnders is always like that, although very on the dramatic side when you look at EastEnders. I interviewed Shauna McGarty recently. We interviewed her on the Today Show. She's Whitney in the EastEnders and she joined the show at 15 and she's now, I think, about 32 and leaving the show herself. So she felt she wanted to leave because she felt she was typecast and she wanted to do other things. She's actually a really good singer too. But going back to Gail, Helen Wirth in Corrie, she was 23 years old when she joined the show. So she's 50 years in the show. So she grew up on the show. You know, every part of her life, she lived that parallel life of Coronation Street. And, you know, back in the day, I suppose, that was the way, if you got into a show like that, you'd stay forever. And she had a great time in the show. She's come out, she said she's quitting now, she feels it's the right time to go, and she's loved every minute of her show. But she's had some dramatic storylines along the way. She's had many dramatic and very unsavoury husbands, like this fella, Richard. Do you remember him? Let's have a listen.
I'd rather they live with the stigma forever than live with you for another second.
Gail, I know I scared you just now, but you can trust me, I swear. No one else will ever get hurt. And now it's out in the open. There's no need for any more lies. I'll always be loyal to you.
Oh, yeah. You'll never have a seedy little affair. You might hit me in the face with a shovel.
No, never.
You think your dad running off with another woman's a worse crime than clubbing someone to death? You're twisted. You're Norman Bates with a briefcase.
That is Gail there chatting to Richard, her husband, her third husband. He turned out to be a serial killer. She wasn't really looking in love, was she, when you think about it? But she did have some great times in the soap over the years, and she had great storylines, as we said there. Now, Fair City, our own Fair City, is one of those soaps that is actually going from strength to strength. It started back in 1989. Tony Tormey, a good friend of our show, the Today Show, he's often on with us, and I'm sure of this show as well. He's been in the soap for 35 years. So really, when you think about it, it can be part of your life forever. The soaps are still going from strength to strength, but people watch in different ways now.
If they watch it at all. Moira getting her soap on during Morning Musings on Oliver Callan today. It started with Lady Gaga and then it moved on to Cyndi Lauper.
Going back to the 80s, my era, Cyndi Lauper, pop star huge at that time, actually has had her hands and footprints enshrined on the Hollywood Walk of Fame near the Chinese Theatre there. I remember being really underwhelmed when I went there years ago, actually. I thought it'd be something. Anyway, that's just me. But anyway, Cher was there to support her, of course. Let's take a little clip.
There are singers. It's like, I'm a good singer. I'm a pretty good singer. Cyndi is a great singer. She's a genius singer. We did it one time. We were on the Divas together and we were doing Turn Back Time and I'm singing it and I'm really feeling good about myself. And she comes out and blows me away. So, and we've been friends ever since.
It's been a whirlwind again, but thank you very much. I'm honored, you know, all those times bowing in front of my shower curtain when I was 9. And here I am. I just want to say thank you. It's really a surreal moment because, you know, I love glamour and I love Hollywood. Come on. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Come on. I just love it. Come on. I love her. 70 years of age, about to go off on another world tour all over the States. I'd love if she came here. I'd definitely be dancing in the front row to that. Cher is amazing too. I think Cher is about 78 now. What women they are, aren't they? Absolutely unreal.
As long as she's having fun, because that's all she really wants, right? Sorry. Maura Duran extolling the virtues of Cyndi Lauper, who got her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame recently. And that's where we draw the shower curtain on the Morning Musings for another day. Fighting Blindness is hosting the Retina International World Congress in Dublin this week. Paul Boskind, Tony Award-winning Broadway producer, psychologist, entrepreneur and LGBTQ activist, will be speaking at the Congress, and he and Professor David Keegan, board member of Fighting Blindness, joined Claire Byrne in studio this morning. Paul told Claire how he discovered he had Stargardt disease.
I knew I had problems seeing like other people. I went to an ophthalmologist who referred me to other eye specialists. And then finally, after a number of encounters with eye specialists, I was informed that I had Stargardt's and that it's central vision loss. So it explained why I was having trouble reading the phone book at the time or why I could not see in my microbiology lab in the microscope what other students were seeing. And I was told that I was going to go blind. And I remember asking, you mean like pitch black, dark, can't see anything blind? And the ophthalmologist said, yes. Whew, deep breath. Mm-hmm. And I said, and when will this happen? And he said, well, we don't really know for sure, but you'll be the first to know.
Well, that didn't sound like a very sensitive consultation.
Exactly, it wasn't. And I got no referrals for support or here, you need to see a psychologist or a counselor. He left the room and I was dumbfounded.
Mm-hmm. And so, what happened after that then in terms of your eyesight?
The eyesight, I was legally blind at the time. I was using low vision aids and I was in undergrad, but I was floundering. I had changed my major 7 times and had changed 3 different universities. Truth be known, I think I was running from my own sexual orientation. I'm a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
And what ended up happening was I decided to get my act together. After a while of being pretty sad and depressed with that prognosis, and so I hustled up and finished my undergraduate degree and then got accepted into a master's program in clinical psychology in the San Antonio area where I'm from. And then I subsequently was accepted at Hofstra University in the New York City area to get my doctorate degree in clinical and school psychology. So I'm a licensed psychologist and have gone on to build a really large private practice where I employ close to 500 clinicians who work for me as W-2 salaried folks.
Mm-hmm. So you had a hugely successful career despite what happened in that room with that prognosis. You also have an Irish castle, which I really want to touch on as well. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I did 23andMe genetic testing and was shocked to find out that I'm predominantly Irish. Boskind is a good German-Dutch name. And I knew on my paternal side that my grandfather spoke German, as did my grandmother. Now, I'd never met them because I was born after they were around. But it's on my mom's side that I have the Irish heritage. And so when you discover that you're Irish, what do?
Come to Ireland.
You got it. So my husband and I at the time came to Ireland and we stayed in castles, we looked at castles, and dadgummit, if I didn't open my mouth to the driver one morning and said, are any of these castles for sale?
As you do. It's
kind of the way I think as a businessman and as an investor in real estate. And so I ended up buying a castle.
How's that gone for you?
It has gone beautifully. 6 years ago, it's a 6-story tower house. And it was rubble at the time. And so I love creative outlets and projects. And so it was my focus. And I would come to Ireland ongoing, regularly, to interface with the design and with the contractors and the architects and the engineers. And it was... I was in my element.
Well, you're one of our own. Now, let's come back to the eyes, David, and thank you very much for being with us as well. Can you tell us a little bit about this condition, Stargardt disease? What is it?
Right. Well, thank you for having me on with Paul this morning. This is it's great to hear Paul's story. And before I talk about Stargardt's in particular, just reflecting on Paul's story, and I'd love to say it's a very unique story that Paul has just told. For Paul's sake and for the listeners, but it's an all too familiar story, particularly going back 20, 30, 35 years of that lack of knowledge around genetic eye disease or rare eye conditions and a shrug of the shoulders mentality that was often proffered. And this has been backed up then by clear research about the delay in getting a diagnosis for years. 5, 6, 7, 10 years in getting a diagnosis, even a clinical diagnosis, seeing multiple medical practitioners with different levels of advice, and then not being referred on for the proper support services.
Mm-hmm.
Patients can understand that there might be some active disease modifying treatment or cure available. But what's very hard to explain, and it should be, and haven't had to explain, is why you don't get support with that. We've got support services here through Fighting Blindness, through Vision Ireland, Guide Dogs for the Blind, Child Vision if it's for children. They need to be referred on to the right services so that they can be supported to live an independent, full life.
But those referrals are happening now. Please tell me they are.
They're happening now. They are.
But not all the time necessarily, right?
Not all the time, but not in all countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have it. So we've built a network in Ireland over the last 8 years, collaboration with Fighting Blindness, with Belfast Trust, my own hospital, Mater Hospital, the Ioneer Hospital, to create that infrastructure. We've then linked with Fighting Blindness and with Vision Ireland and with a key appointment thing called an eye clinic liaison officer. Now that coordinates that access to psychological and supportive rehab care. We've transferred that care as well for the vision impaired and blind, which is predominantly age related in many years for the vermacular generation, to a life cycle model. So there's a specific program for children. Many children with disabilities will be seen mainly in child vision. Children without disabilities with vision impairment will be seen through the Vision Ireland program. But then right the way up through school, college, working. One of our key goals across all of this is improving the employment opportunities for those with vision impairment and blindness. A shocking statistic from a couple of years ago, 16% of severe vision impaired or blind in the working age population were in paid employment. Now, that we've risen that up to, won't go into, it's not for today, but that's risen up to around 24, 25%.
It's still very low.
It's still very, very low. Mm-hmm. It's not acceptable.
That's Fighting Blindness board member Professor David Keegan, who, along with Paul Boskind, spoke to Claire Byrne this morning about the Retina International World Congress that's taking place in Dublin this week. On this afternoon's Liveline, Joe Duffy heard from a number of callers whose holidays have been affected by problems that seem to be happening at online booking company loveholidays.ie. Here's Tara.
Our flight actually got delayed, and that was kind of a blessing in the end.
Okay.
But a friend of ours had flown out ahead of us and got to the hotel and was told a third party had gone insolvent and we couldn't check in. And we weren't arriving until all hours of the morning. It was 2 o'clock in the morning before we kind of got out of the airport. We would have been arriving to a hotel with nowhere to stay for that night. I was lucky enough like that I was able to notify my dad and he got us an apartment while we were on the flight. But we only heard of this on the runway. Love Holidays never informed us of anything at all.
And how much had you paid Love Holidays?
It was over 1,300 altogether for a holiday.
So you had paid your
We'd paid in full.
Okay, David, what happened? Where are you now, Tara?
We were in an apartment that we had to get ourselves.
Yeah,
Love Holidays still haven't come in. In Lanzarote.
Lanzarote. Okay, David Phelan. David, what happened to you in Love Holidays?
Well, our story was, Joe, we were initially booked to fly out of Cork Airport on Tuesday morning at 5.50am. So we set off to the airport, arrived in Cork Airport and realised, looking at the boards, checking to see what time where the gate was, no flight to Gran Canaria. So I spoke with someone in the airport and they told me, sorry, your flight left yesterday. And I was like, sure, all my travel documents state that I'd be travelling today. And no, that was it. So all came to all, we just headed back for home because we knew we were flying out of Cork.
And all your travel documentation, what letter heading, what was the company it was under?
It was Love Holidays.
So they told you that your flight was on Tuesday. You arrived on Tuesday and you were told, oh, by the way, that flight was changed.
Yep.
When did you book the flight? When did you pay?
I was paid back in last September, early October, Joe.
Okay. Had you, and so you had children with you, so they're obviously... Everyone's disappointed. So you went home. What did you do?
Well, when I got home, like, there was devastation because this is our first family holiday together. We have a 10-year-old, 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. And this is actually our first foreign family holiday, so there was wicked excitement.
Yeah.
Wicked excitement turned to wicked bad. The kids were absolutely devastated. They were roaring, crying. They were, you know, just pure disheartened. So when I got back, I got back at 9 a.m, I actually got through to someone in Love Holidays because they do have an Irish, an Irish number based in Carlow or somewhere like that. But I don't know if the godsend is actually in Carlow. But I got in contact with a lovely girl. She said, "Look, I'm so sorry. We looked into it. That was Tuesday. Yesterday was Wednesday. Rang him yesterday. Still same thing. Oh, it's been looked into. Blah, blah, blah." I'm actually currently in Dublin Airport as we speak, Joe.
Okay.
Waiting to get on a 3 p.m. flight out to Gran Canaria out of my own pocket again.
Well, you've rebooked the whole family.
I did. Yeah, I did. And I had to borrow that money, Joe, to book this holiday again.
I can't imagine how much that cost.
I couldn't leave the devastation happen to happen. The kids were absolutely so excited to go. And then, absolutely heartbroken.
Now, we get on to Ryanair, in fairness, and they say the flight from Cork to Gran Canaria was due to depart at 0555 on Tuesday, the 4th of June. However, due to a routine scheduled adjustment, it was subsequently rescheduled to depart a day earlier at 0550 on Monday, the 3rd of June. An email notification was sent to the email address provided on the passenger's booking at 7:08 on the 12th of October last year. Advising them of their options to either accept this flight time change, move flight free or charge, or receive a full refund. The email address, this passenger, as far as Ryanair understand, the email address accepted the flight change at 08:28 on the 12th of October last year. Were you aware of that? No, obviously.
No, Joe, because do you know what happened was, when you book with Love Holidays, now it has changed since January, when you book with Love Holidays, they set up a genetical email address on your behalf. I had no access to that Gmail. Why would I turn up to a flight on a Tuesday morning, not knowing that it was gone 24 hours before?
So who has access to that email that loveholidays.ie
set up on your behalf?
Well, Ryanair are adamant, and they do, in fairness. Anyone that travels with Ryanair, as I do, or Aer Lingus, as I do, you know, if there's a change, you'll get a text or a rapid email telling you well in advance of that change. So this email, loveholidays.ie, which is their Irish incarnation, Ryanair are adamant that they sent them, who did the booking, an email last October to say the flight had been changed, which is, in fairness to them, a lot of notice. It's 7 months, eight months' notice. And they say the email address accepted the flight change, but they never forwarded it to you. They never told you.
No, because all my travel itinerary was for Tuesday, Joe. Tuesday the 4th to Tuesday the 11th. Or Tuesday, whatever the Tuesday was. All my documentation I had printed off was all dates Tuesday to Tuesday.
Okay, now.
Not Monday to Monday.
Love Holidays are saying that the problem is that FTI, which is a German travel company, is the parent company of one of our many accommodation and transfer suppliers. It's a parent company of U Travel. On Monday this week, the FTI group announced it was filing for insolvency. Loveholiday.ie tell us we asked them for a spokesperson, they were unable. We would like to stress that a very small proportion of Loveholidays.ie customers are affected by this news. And we are working closely with our wider network of suppliers to honour all existing bookings and minimise any disruption. As a context, this is the equivalent of less than 3% of all forward bookings in Ireland. But as a context, you're shedding out 100%, David. Your holiday, so you had to rebook flights off your own bat at very short notice, which are expensive to say the least. And what about accommodation?
Well, I rang our initial accommodation on Tuesday to inform of us and actually coming on Tuesday. And the lady, in fairness, the place we're staying was absolutely fantastic on the phone, Joe. She said, look, you have this apartment booked from today till next Tuesday. But she said, get on your new flight on Thursday and come out and there won't be a problem. We'll sort you out. Your apartment is here for you when you come on Thursday. So that was off a number, a direct number that I rang, that it was on the booking information. I rang the direct line to the accommodation. Now, Joe, I'm down €2,500 more.
Wow.
Of €2,000 already spent.
Good God. And have loveholidays.ie been on to you?
No. I've been contacting them numerous of times, and one time was the only time yesterday I got through to them since Tuesday.
That was David, one of a number of callers to this afternoon's live line, telling Joe Duffy about the very poor experience they've had with online travel company loveholidays.ie. Do you have too much stuff in your life? Yes, you do. Does all of that stuff spark joy in your life? No, it does not. Why don't you get rid of it? That would be the Marie Kondo method. Marie who, maybe you're asking, because you missed her Netflix series a couple of years ago. Well, let former arts worker Aidan Gately, Maura Duran's guest this morning, get you up to speed.
I call her the Japanese tidying guru, so some people will know her from her Netflix programme. Her first book was The Magical Art of Tidying Up, and her kind of tagline is Spark Joy. So she's all about kind of asking yourself, when you're decluttering and tidying, does this thing spark joy? Do I want it in my life? So yeah, I watched her Netflix programme, or watched like the first episode, and straight away was running in to refold my t-shirts in the way that she kind of recommends, which is kind of in thirds. Mine was already folded, kind of a bit of a neat freak, I suppose, anyway, but her system did work. It creates more space in your drawers, it's easier to see your clothes, etc. So yeah, I got obsessed, I suppose, Emma, in a nice way. I bought her book, I read the book, and that really kind of resonated with me. It felt like a lot of the things kind of she felt and did throughout her life were similar in a way to mine or something. So yeah, really loved her book. And
but
then,
you went further though, you became a condo marriage consultant. What is that?
Yeah, so I was on her website one day and realised, wow, there's a consultant tab, and you can click in here and you can actually train to become like a marriage condo consultant, so you can help people do this. So yeah, so I a con marriage consultant is somebody who uses Marie Kondo's method, which is the con marriage method, to declutter their houses. Because I suppose around the world there are a lot of professional organisers and declutterers, but there's only about 600 con marriage consultants worldwide. There's only about 5 of us in Ireland, so it's quite a niche kind of thing. And she has a very kind of strategic, simple to follow method that we like to think makes tidying up your house easier. It helps you not rebound. So it's very kind of strategic in that she tidies by category and not by location. And that's one of the main kind of differences, I think, as well. So yeah, so once I found out that, wow, I could do this potentially as a career, I signed up to do the course. It was supposed to happen in London in May of 2020, which didn't happen. But we pivoted and we did it online kind of instead. And that's how it all kind of started to roll for me.
It's interesting, as you said, there are 600 of the con marriage consultants in the world, or condo marriage consultants in the world, and there are only 10 men, but 5 of them in Ireland. I didn't know Irish men were that tidy, to be honest. I haven't met many of them in my life, but you're obviously one.
There's about 10 male tidying consultants worldwide. No, there's only 5 regular tidying consultants in Ireland, and I'm the only male.
Oh, you're the only
male.
So, oh, okay. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
So it is.
Anyway, tell us a little bit about it. You're telling us about the method. How do you sort this out? Because I've got texts coming in already. Hi, Maura. I moved into a new home in 2019. I still have boxes and boxes not opened and sorted. There are 2 rooms in the house that hold these boxes. I cannot motivate myself to start cleaning or clearing. I feel overwhelmed. They look unsightly too. That's from Esther. And actually, for me, as a person who gets overwhelmed every time I look at a pile, tell me and help me how to get through this. What do I do?
Yeah. Well, I suppose recognizing where you are first, and what I love to do with people is get them to that place where they're not overwhelmed, because their homes should be a sanctuary and they should be a place of peace and calm when we close the door in the evening. So that person, Esther, who has those boxes, in some ways, she's starting from a really good place, because actually she now has her clutter already boxed up. So literally just takes it box by box, you know. So what I'd be suggesting, because looking into those rooms, she's getting overwhelmed because there's so much stuff. So what I would say first is, you know, forgive herself for it happening, because we're all humans and we all accumulate stuff. So what I'd do before she even takes out a box to go through it, I'd get some more boxes, empty boxes from your local supermarket or cardboard boxes, whatever you have, some stickers or some post-it notes, and put them keep, donate and recycle. Because what you want is, you don't want to pull out a box, start going through it, and have nowhere to put the stuff. Because that's all clutter is homeless stuff. It's really, really simple. So what you need to do, and anybody else listening as well who has that tidy, messy kind of press or drawer or room or garage or whatever, so get 3 boxes, get 3 even just bags, keep, donate and recycle on them. Have your normal waste bag as well beside you. Then take out your box and put it on the kitchen table, the dining table, even on the floor, and go through each item one by one. It's not a quick thing. You won't go through a whole room in the morning, but you'll be amazed how much you will go through. And then just ask yourself, when you open up that box, and especially for Esther there, she's moved in 2019, so that's 5 years. She hasn't needed, let's say, the stuff in those rooms. So there is a chance that maybe she doesn't need a lot of stuff in that room. But also, there could be stuff in those boxes, in those rooms, that are really sentimental to her, stuff that she's forgotten she has and that she loves. So as you take it out, ask yourself, does it spark joy? It's where you would say, do I love it? Do I need it? Do I like it? Do I want to wear it? Do I want to use it? Do I want it in this new home, in my new life, kind of going forward? And if the answer is yes, it goes into keep. And if you're kind of doubting yourself and kind of going, I'm not sure, trust your gut. If you're not saying yes kind of straight away, then it's time to gratefully let it go without any guilt, without any shame, and put it into the donate or the recycle section.
That's interesting. You see, I read that book too, that Spark Joy one, and then I lifted up a dress that I had forever and I said, okay, does this spark joy? And it didn't spark massive joy, but I kind of then started thinking of the history of the dress, where I bought it, that I got it on a sale. It was an expensive dress, and I just put it back where I found it. So that's my issue. But you help people with clothes, with all sorts of things. How do you do this? Is it mostly clothes or is it other stuff? Is it kitchen or bedroom, or how do you manage it?
Yeah, so it depends on the person. You know, if somebody wants to do a full, what Marie and the KonMari method does is a tidying festival. So that's where somebody will come to me and say, look, I want to tidy everything in my life, all my possessions. I want to do it once and for all and never have to do it again. And that's the tidying festival. And that one I love doing, because that's where we literally start with somebody's clothes and we go to all of their clothes. And it's very strategic. We don't move on to the next category, which is books, until we're finished clothes. After books, we do all of the paper in the house. Then we do all of the miscellaneous items, which is kimono, which includes everything from DVDs, CDs, like swimming goggles, hobby items, right down to the food in the fridge. And then the last thing, and maybe your dress needs to live in this section, is the sentimental items. Because, you know, what's sentimental to me, what's sentimental to you is different. Some people might think a chair, and correctly, is sentimental for them for family reasons. Somebody else, it might be beer mats or key rings or something. So anything like that, like if I'm working with a client and there's something sentimental in clothes or books or paper, we just push that to the side. We make a little area and we say, we'll come back to that at the end. Because by the time they've kind of joy checked and gone through all of the other items in the categories, when you come to their sentimental items, it'll be easier then for them to decide if they want to keep it or let it go. You know, and Marie Kondo and this method and what I do with clients, it's not about minimalism. It's that you don't have to get rid of everything. I always tell my clients, look, you can literally keep everything you want in your house and we'll just restore it better. But they never do. But you need to give people that permission to keep stuff, because it's, and that's what I kind of tell them as well, when we're facing into a pile of clothes, or even, you know, when people come to me and they don't have time for a tidying festival, it's like, let's just tackle the wardrobe because it's overflowing, or the kitchen. I said, look, just look at this pile of clothes or look at the kitchen, and it's a kind of a, like a treasure hunt. Let's make it fun. Let's find the things you love and you want and you need. And that makes it just, you kind of flip the psychology on it and it becomes more positive. Instead of looking at it thinking, I have to get rid of half of this, and you already feel bad for yourself. So flip it the other way, find what you love, and then it's just about gratefully discarding the rest. Because as humans, we accumulate so much stuff. Some of the things we buy for ourselves, but other stuff we just accumulate from other people, and we never maybe give ourselves a chance to kind of curate it ourselves.
That's Aidan Gately, one of a select few Marie Kondo consultants in the world, talking about tidying up and sparking joy with Maura Duran this morning. It was good news and bad news for sufferers from inflammatory bowel disease this week. A major breakthrough in the search for a cause of the disease was announced, but researchers say it will still be at least 5 years before treatments are available. This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to Professor Humphrey O'Connor, consultant gastroenterologist, about what the research disclosed and what it all means.
The study comes from the laboratory called the Genetic Mechanisms of Disease Laboratory in the Crick Institute in London. And what James Lee and his colleagues have found, that in one particular part of the genome, on chromosome 21, there's a little patch that seems to be able to enhance the activity of a particular gene, which in turn affects an inflammatory or an immune cell called the macrophage. The macrophage is part of our immune system. It's in all the tissues in the body. And that cell appropriately responds in a way to infection, where it gobbles up the bacterium, disposes of dead cells, and pours out proteins, cytokines, that recruit other parts of the immune system. So that's appropriate if you and I got an infection. Mm-hmm. Situation here is that our colleagues in London have have seen from their research, and it's very good. It's high science there. This enhancer in that part of the chromosome that drives this gene, ETS2, to then drive the macrophage to inappropriately pour out, do what it should do to create inflammation in situations where it's not appropriate. And this is the type, that is the scenario that faces people with inflammatory bowel disease. They have a chronic inflammatory process in their gut of unknown cause. They didn't get it for any reason. And it keeps remitting, relapsing as they go through life.
A lifelong condition in many cases, Humphrey, with no cure.
Absolutely. I think that, I mean, I don't mean to sound depressing, but I think that summed it up. I mean, we've treatments have evolved. If you were to go back 20 years, say, that was the beginning of the development of agents that selectively knocked out some of those cytokines, those inflammatory proteins. And that is so the last 20 years, we've seen the development of 5, 6, 7 of those, and patients have been treated very effectively mm-hmm. with those agents. But we're treating the inflammation without quite knowing what's driving it in the first place.
So what this might be leading us to, this discovery, is that fact that this immune response now, which has been discovered, that might be treated with medication at source rather than treating what it causes.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, as James Lee says, they've uncovered a pathway. It might be overstating it to say we have a new cure for those lifelong conditions. I don't mean to be pessimistic in any way, but that pathway might allow, for instance, the development of medication further back along the line, and that, again, might be more effective in controlling the inflammation. Mm-hmm. But the catch is like this. We need our macrophages to protect us against infection and other insults. It's part of our innate immune system. Our colleagues in London say, don't switch off that gene. They just reduce its activity because it's a trade-off. You can imagine that if you stop the macrophage working, then a whole load of useful cytokines that it produces are not produced.
So you have to balance this then.
Absolutely. I mean, and that in clinical terms, when you're sitting with a patient talking about their treatment, the debate is about risk and benefit. This is not in any way to diminish what our colleagues in London have done, which is terrific. And it really gives insight into what might underlie some of what's happening to drive the inflammation in Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
So this description then of this discovery as being a massive mm-hmm. step forward, do you agree that that's what it is?
I think it's a step forward. Yes, I think it's very important. It's very important because it takes you back to that. I mean, there are lots of other environmental familial factors and so on that are there in the mix as potential causes of inflammatory bowel disease. But perhaps you're born with some slight genetic defect in that particular part of that chromosome. It's a very small bit. Mm-hmm. And having that and go on to do other things, your diet isn't right, or you're smoking strongly linked with Crohn's. Curiously, non-smoking is linked with ulcerative colitis. So I think we have to put genetic, immune, environmental factors together. But this unknown piece of the jigsaw is important, Claire, in terms of what will happen.
And you and I have spoken on this programme before about the fact that cases of IBD, irritable bowel disease, they're becoming more common. And why is that the case? Do we know?
Well, if you look in this country, we have at least 40,000 people living with inflammatory bowel disease. Worldwide, 4.9 million. USA is the highest. And it's increasing. And when we've talked in the past about if a disease is changing quickly, it's not genetics. It's much more likely to be environmental factors that are driving that change.
Diet?
Diet. I mean, when you think of your gut, you have to equate it with diet. But again, the ideal diet has not been worked out. One of the suppositions at the moment is that a diet a la the Mediterranean diet might be more helpful. Mm-hmm. Exercise. I don't mean to be vague, Claire, but we're not as hot as we should be in terms of understanding the dietary items, and then the microbiome in the gut, and the bacterial factors that produces.
That's Professor Humphrey O'Connor, consultant gastroenterologist, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about developments in the search for a cause of inflammatory bowel disease. Everyone, try to remain calm, including our host, because Nicola Coughlan and Luke Newton are in this next bit. That's right, on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, Catherine Thomas, sitting in for Ray, spoke to the stars of what must be the biggest show on streaming, Bridgerton. Listener, it was a breathless conversation.
Here, how are you feeling? Lovely. Are you exhausted, first of
we're
all?
We're exhausted. We're okay. We're holding it together, I feel. Because this is we call it our victory lap. We've done most of the world tour now, and this is us winding down.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Well, like the definition of a whistle-stop world tour, you were in Toronto on Monday.
Yeah.
The press tour has taken you to Australia, Italy, Brazil.
Yes, yeah. New York. We did New York twice, I think. Yeah. Oh,
do you know what day it is?
Nope.
You know, you're not the only one. It's bank holiday week in Ireland, so no one has a rashers.
Right,
what
okay.
day it is. But it's Thursday, just in case you need to know.
I actually didn't know that.
I would have said Wednesday if you put a gun to my head. I'm like, it's Wednesday.
Yeah. But Camille, how do you manage and cope with the jet lag and the, you know, doing the press tour? It's full on, like tiring, but exciting, but tiring.
Yeah. I think like meeting people kind of fuels you a bit.
It does, actually.
You get
very true.
And like even here, I was saying previously, like I love... Like everyone, the Irish people just really make you feel like they're your friend immediately.
Okay.
And it's so nice to just like interact with people like on the streets and
everywhere. I said to Luke, is my accent getting thicker and thicker as the day goes on.
Galway's coming back.
I know, because I feel like when I'm away, I'll try and slow down because obviously natural Galway pace is like da 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 da. But then I'll be home like tomorrow, you won't be able to understand me.
Love it. And you are going home tomorrow. Yeah. So it's the glitzy screening tonight.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is in the Lighthouse Cinema here in Dublin.
It is.
Then you're off to Galway, your hometown.
I know.
Back to the Palace.
I know. I can't believe it.
That's going to be a special moment.
It's just, I really like never thought anything like this would happen. Like to get to bring like Netflix and Bridgerton to Galway and bring Luke to Galway and show him round. And
So cool.
And when was the last time you were home?
Oh gosh. We've been on the press tour since the 4th of January.
Okay.
That's when we started. So I've been home maybe twice since then, and I had Big Mood, another show, come out within that time period, and I was promoting that too. So it's been a little while.
Is it weird going home now back to Galway, back to your mammy, when you're trying to kind of walk the pier or have, you know, head out to the weir and have a pint and do all that?
I think probably in this period of time between the releases, it's quite wild. Like, you know, you're kind of like all the airport bathrooms, you're going in and you've just come out of the toilet. People are like, you're a Lady Whistledown. You go, I am. Yeah. I am. I have to wash my hands
and get a selfie beside the jacks.
Yeah, yeah. Someone did ask me for a selfie in the bathroom. I was like, let's go outside the bathroom and we'll do it out there.
But will you be able to even take a few hours in Galway? I mean, Luke, have you been to Galway before?
No,
never.
First time.
Okay,
yeah.
So if you were to, you know, I mean, it's highly unlikely that you're going to get the time or the opportunity to do it, but if you were to show him the best of Galway, what would a few
hours?
We are doing it tomorrow. So I think he doesn't know where I'm bringing him, so I have to keep a secret. Yeah. But I am bringing him around Galway tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Love it. But you can't say anything.
No, it has to be because he doesn't know where we're going. So I'm going to keep it secret.
Yeah, I'm going to be blindfolded.
And Luke, you are from Shoreham-by-Sea.
Yes.
Which I have actually been to.
Oh,
really?
Yes, I have because I have family in Petersfield and Chichester, not too far away.
Yeah, very close.
So I was there maybe 5 years ago.
Wow.
But if you were to bring Nicola to Shoreham-by-Sea.
Oh, wow.
What would you be doing for an hour or two?
Just like a walk along the beach is really beautiful. I'd probably venture closer to Brighton and do the pier. I love doing like the arcades.
I love Brighton Pier.
I don't love rides, but I know that you do.
I do like them. Roller
coasters. And
so yeah, I'd be like, there you go.
Off you go.
I'd hold your bag.
Thank you. That's very nice.
Yeah. What about you, Nicola? Like home comforts. Like, will you get to stay in Galway for a few days?
Or? I will. I get to stay with my family for a little bit, which is nice. Because, yeah, it's been, as you said, such a whistle-stop world tour. Mm. So, yeah, see my niece and nephews. And actually, I have one nephew in the Gaeltacht, so I can't see him.
Oh, God.
I know.
Oh, well, let's say big hello.
Hi, Christian.
Probably.
You're not listening because you're in the Gaeltacht.
But good to hang out with your mom for a little bit as well.
I
know she's one of your biggest fans.
Oh, yeah. And she hasn't met Luke yet.
Okay. Yeah. Oh,
he is the big flavor of the month. I won't see my mum actually. She'll probably be way too wrapped up in what Luke Nathan's doing. Yeah.
It took a while for her to warm to Colin, didn't
it? Well, my mom is really into like favoritism. It's one of her best things.
Yeah.
So she loved it. Was all about Anthony and then Benedict. And then now it's like she doesn't care about those guys.
Okay. It's all about Colin.
I was home recently and I was in bed and she came into me and she said, you know what I love about him? It's just you can tell he's so nice. And you can tell he's so, and I was like, it's so lovely. I'm really tired. I want to go to sleep. And she just kept monologuing at me about Luke. So now she gets to see him in the flesh tomorrow. Yeah. So I'll be old news.
I know you say she's on the phone the whole time getting the updates from the.
And I read this thing about you. And why are they saying that? And I'm like, don't worry, it's not everything on the internet's true, Mum. Like, this is grand.
So let's talk about that steamy carriage scene.
Sure.
Like, what was your mom's reaction?
Well, what my mum saw of the carriage scene was Colin getting in, them having a conversation, one kiss, a very long fast forward, and then will you marry me?
Yeah.
But shut tomorrow, up, I don't know. I genuinely, in real time, I'm like, what am I going to do?
Yeah. Oh, that's a difficult one.
It's like, it's worse in that sense.
I mean, none of us like sitting down with our parents and watching any sort
and
of
this
sex
is scene. Another level.
This is another level.
You probably would have been better off letting us see the carriage scene and then not tomorrow's episode or tonight's episode.
No, I don't.
Well, you know what? Have either of you listened to the audio description when you put it on Netflix?
I've seen this on TikTok.
Yeah, I've seen
this
it.
This has
as
gone
well.
Viral on TikTok. Yeah. It is absolutely hilarious.
But there's one thing that doesn't, it's not real. Do you know the bit it's the extra line.
Yeah. They say that I whisper something in your ear and it's not in the script.
It's definitely
and
not
said
it.
Doesn't
happen.
Okay, well, let's take a listen.
Okay.
Oh, really?
They share a scorching kiss. He wraps his arm around her waist. They separate for a brief moment.
That's where we have to cut it.
No.
That's where we have to cut it.
Wow.
It's so good. It's so good when you listen to it in its full entirety.
Yeah,
so everybody do that.
Yes.
But come here. I mean, it is a brilliant scene.
Oh,
it's just so brilliant. And I mean, fans of the book would have known that it was coming down the line. But what was going through your minds when you knew that this was going to be Penn and Colin's big moment?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it was a really big moment for them. We sort of had different sort of stages that they go through in the first block, in the first part.
Yeah.
And then we'll also get there in the second part as well. But like the first kiss was a big moment.
Yeah, that was terrifying.
It was like a different energy.
Why
on
was
set
it terrifying?
Because we've known each other for years and it's very scary to like, you can't fake kiss someone on screen, you have to kiss them. So like, you're like, what if it looks bad? What if the audience don't feel the chemistry in that moment?
Yeah.
And we'd played them as friends for so long and that's the moment where everything changes for Colin. So a lot banked on it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was scary. But the carriage, we'd known about it for years and we knew it was coming. But
it was just so, you nailed it so well. It was like drama, the suspense, the sexual tension.
Yeah.
And you know, my favorite part was the laugh.
I know.
The laugh. Yeah. It was so real.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah,
it really
that's what
is
I
like,
think is so beautiful about this season is like you, because we have, you know, the characters have known each other for so long that there's a level of intimacy there that we haven't gotten to explore before in the show.
Yeah.
And you'll see it more in the second half of like how they just really love being with one another and have so much fun, because that's so truthful to real life. When it's true intimacy, you do giggle and you do have those silly moments in the most romantic of times, you know?
Totally, totally. And can I ask you, like, when you get together, I mean, it's very visible on screen, but the chemistry between you, I mean, and that's what I think maybe people don't understand. You've been on this juggernaut for 3 seasons, but you've known each other for 5 years.
Yes,
And like, it was your big break, Luke, to say, is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you've kind of come on this mad journey together.
Yeah. No, totally. It's been wild. Like the whole, I think that also is something that's really important to like to Colin and Penn, that they, the audience has had that history with them mm. and that we've had that shared experience. Mm. You know, it's not only us like putting this episode out now and feeling like it's 5 years of work being on screen. Yeah. It's like the audience has been there and supported them this whole time and has been looking forward to this romance blossoming. So it's kind of a surreal moment. It's not like we're celebrating one season. It's like we're celebrating all three put 100%. Together, like the work of all of them. So,
it's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible. And look, we know that Colin declared very early in the season that he will do whatever he can to ruin the Tom's Gossip columnist if he ever finds out who she is. And of course, we all know that Penelope is Lady Whistledown. And that kind of moves the show and the series on. Like, it moves the suspense up a notch. And of course, we all want to know what's going to happen, but it's a very clever bridge, isn't it?
Oh yeah. I mean, I knew that the break would mean that people would be celebrating that there's a proposal, but people would also be like stressed at the fact you know, the Whistledown secret is still to be revealed. So yeah, that was really exciting to sort of play those moments. Like, you know, as we go into part two, Colin is just like happy and giddy and
it's
full of
so
joy.
Lovely.
Don't ruin Colin's joy. Maybe he should talk to a Condo Marie consultant. That is, of course, Luke Newton and Nicola Coughlan, stars of Bridgerton, talking to Catherine Thomas this morning. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, if you were tuned into Oliver Callan yesterday morning, and why wouldn't you be? You would have heard Maura talk about a condition known as dyscalculia, which causes difficulty for a person when it comes to numbers and maths. This morning, Maura spoke to Kate Shelley from Dingle, who'd heard the mention of dyscalculia and wanted to share her experience of the condition.
You said you grew up believing that you were stupid because you couldn't read the clock or you couldn't do simple sums.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, you know, because I was quite, you know, ashamed of not being able to read clocks or do simple sums. And, you know, like a lot of people that have dyslexia or dyscalculia or things similar to that, you know, a lot of people are actually very intelligent and, you know, think outside the box. And then it's really disheartening to be perceived as stupid or to perceive yourself particularly as stupid or unable and out of place, or that there's no use for your skills. So, yeah, I remember the teacher asked me to go and read the clock, you know, because I was a good girl. They sent me out to the hallway to read the clock, tell the teacher what the time is. And I just stood there for, it seemed like an eternity, and not knowing what I was going to do or how I was going to go back into the class and say that I couldn't read the clock.
Can I ask you when this was? What year around or what decade?
So I would have been about maybe eight.
Yeah, and when
eight
was this?
10.
What year was that? Around what year?
Oh, in the 80s.
You see, that's why I'm asking, because, you know, we were, you know, grew up in those times, things were very, very different. You would never do that to kids these days. And I suppose everyone was expected that you could expect that the clock, basically, you could read the clock. But how did the clock look to you? I mean, did the clock look different to you? Or what did you see when you looked at the clock?
Yeah, so the way that I describe it to people is it just, it looks like as if you're reading a sentence in another language that's not your own, but you can kind of pick out bits, you know, like say if you have to read something in German and French, if you know English, you can kind of make out sentences. So I look at the clock, I can go through the way in my head of like this thing pointing to that number means this, but it takes me a long time to work it out.
Yeah, so clocks and, with hands now would be very confusing for you to look at them.
Yeah, so I can read digital clocks. I have digital clocks in the house.
Yeah, it's interesting really when you think about it, because back in the 80s, we would never have heard that word, and even the teachers in your school had no idea what was going on. It's almost like people with dyslexia, because we've all probably know people with dyslexia now that they had dyslexia back in the day when we were in school, and they were kind of put in the corner and all that because they couldn't read properly, but it was dyslexia because they couldn't see the words properly. When did you realise that you actually had dyscalculia?
It was only about 10 or 15 years ago, because I'm really interested in psychology and the brain, and I was reading a book about neuroplasticity, and they were talking about these people that couldn't, that had difficulty with left and right, with direction, with clocks, not reading clocks, simple sums, and I ticked all the boxes. I was thinking, I didn't know there were other people, and I was talking to my brother about it because he'd have a similar interest, and he said, oh, don't you know, I can't read clocks either.
My goodness.
And And then my children, they have difficulty reading clocks. And it comes with the whole, like, it's, you know, normally, you know, a lot of the time people with dyscalculia have other conditions like, you know, dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, Tourette's, OCD. And that would be, you know, everybody on my dad's line would have a collection of those. Right. And my daughter, she has Tourette's.
Right.
And both my kids would be dyslexic and would be ADHD. And, yeah. But, you know, and they're kind of words that are bandied around a lot now. But I think it's good because my daughter particularly, she reads a lot. The internet is there now. And so there's a lot. And it's just good to know that there's other people. You know, I've been listening to the Blind Boy podcast and he talks a lot about his autism diagnosis. Mm. And it's just great to know that there's creative
Well,
people that are doing
as,
great
as
stuff
you know,
in the world.
Somebody like yourself as well. I mean, people that have things, you know, like dyscalculia or other conditions like ADHD or autism are oftentimes the most creative people in the world.
Absolutely.
And go on to do the most amazing. Elon Musk has Asperger's. It didn't stop him, to be honest. Let's look at that.
Exactly.
But when you see now your children, it must be amazing that you've got a child with Tourette's, that, you know, people in your family, as you said, have ADHD and different diagnoses at this stage. It must be wonderful that we can talk about it now. It must be wonderful for you to see that your daughter can be open about her condition now at the world we live in, compared to back in the 80s when you and I grew up.
Oh, absolutely, because I didn't know. But then even still, like, you know, now gathering with all the people in our family, and I was telling my dad, because it's his side of the family, and, you know, he's got a good collection of of conditions, but he just won't have it. He's complete denial that any of these things exist. So I just think it's really important just for people to be validated. I mean, everybody's got their own unique way of seeing things, and it's just really good to know what are your skills, regardless of what type of, you know, whether you're neurotypical, neurodivergent, what type of, you know, I'm just one person, everyone else has their, you know, my children, they're very different to me, but we have similar things.
It would be
really
a very boring world if we were all the same, and neurodiversity makes us all very, very unique. What I love about you is that you got 95% in your maths in the Leaving Cert, which was amazing, because that's because you could read patterns of maths. So it was just basic maths is what you can't do. That's my issue, is basic maths. You're far more advanced than me when it comes to maths, really. So I think it's all's well that ends well. And I know you do yoga now, before we let you go, and you had your own business, you sold it. So life worked out pretty well for you.
Yeah, I do. Using all the empathy, feeling, colours, interest in psychology, you know, I do energetic readings. So so now I'm just kind of letting my big freak flag fly.
Dyscalculia sufferer Kate Shelley talking to Maura Duran on Oliver Callum this morning. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. I'll be back tomorrow with another bunch of things to spark joy. Until then, thank you for listening and good luck.